The presentation you're about to hear was made by a graduate of Freedom Law School named Joseph Bannister at Freedom Law School's 2000 Freedom Rally in Irvine, California. Mr. Bannister was a gun-carrying special agent fraud investigator with the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS. Mr. Bannister left this high-paying job and rapid career advancement in February of 1999 after he verified that the IRS is extorting billions of dollars from the American people in violation of the U.S. Constitution and its laws. Mr. Joe Bannister.
Okay. Okay, well, I've already done my speech, or actually, Payman already did my speech for me, so let me see if I can adjust things a little bit. I feel like I'm back at the IRS. Alrighty. Well, first off, I don't want people to be too bored. So I'd like to ask how many people were here last year to hear me speak. Oh, good. So how many people weren't here last year? Oh, great. So I don't need to worry about my speech because I'm just going to tell my story. It seems to make people stand up and take notice. I think it tends to make people wonder. I've heard different stories from people, different testimonials about me having my picture on the back of this report or having it on the internet. It's not something I really wanted to have, but apparently having that picture is more than 1,000 words. One lady in particular said that she works out with an FBI agent and a local prosecutor. And she said, you know, I got this new book on the income tax and how it's voluntary. And they said, yeah, right, all that tax protester stuff. And she said, yeah, but this is the guy that wrote it. And they said, oh, do you think I can get a copy of that? So it is kind of unique, I guess, that I happen to come to this frame of mind. So what I'd like to do, I guess, is just explain to you how I got to be on this stage, or how I came to be on the stage last year. It was probably my first public speaking engagement, was at Palin's rally a year ago. Fortunately, I'm still here. I feel like I've had a little bit of a target on my back over the last year, an even bigger one than I had when I was in the IRS. But I'm still here, still happy, still smiling. Hope everybody out here is going to smile and be happy, because we're going to vanquish the enemy. Just remember, though, that the enemy is not necessarily the IRS agents. The enemy is deceit, and our weapon is truth. And it's truth that will help us to win this battle. Anyway. Just give you a brief background about myself. I graduated from San Jose State University in 1986 with an accounting degree. From there I went to KPMG Pete Marwick, which is an international accounting firm. I spent 3 years there, 2 years in the tax department, and a year in the audit department. And the expenses of raising a family got to be a little bit much compared to the salary I was getting at Pete Marwick. So went to my bosses and said, you know, I got to find something that pays a little more. So I moved on into the venture capital industry and spent a little over a year there. And this was in 1990-1991 time frame. And I started to look at what I was doing, sitting behind this desk and doing a lot of number crunching. And I looked at my boss and I thought, you know, I'm really not enjoying myself. I need to find something that makes my motor run and keeps me a little more motivated, because I got to work for another 20, 30, 40 years and stay motivated enough to make a living and feed my family and all those things. So I thought, well, what can I do that would motivate me? And I got this itch, more of a pronounced itch, to get into law enforcement. I thought that that would be my cup of tea, something that would make me motivated, not lose any motivation. So I thought, well, what law enforcement would be good for me? While I was in venture capital, I had taken the CPA exam, got all of my experience needed to get the CPA certificate. And in 1991, January 91, I got my CPA certificate. And so I pretty much had all my ducks in a line to be this certified public accountant, ready to take the world by storm, and then decide I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to get more into law enforcement. But I knew that local police agencies, you know, didn't want a CPA driving around a patrol car and arresting criminals. You know, what good is my experience to do that? But I kept looking and found that the federal government, this was news to me, and maybe to some of you it wasn't news to you, but there were all these different agencies of the federal government, kind of like Paimon's shirt. We're from the government, we're here to help you, and it's got all the agencies. Well, I looked at them all and decided that the two that maybe most suited my experience level was the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. So I sent in an application to both the FBI and the IRS Criminal Investigation Division, or CID. And the FBI answered my application very quickly, like within 2 or 3 weeks. And they called me into the San Francisco office, and I took a battery of examinations, including a psychological examination, which I jokingly say that I don't know how I passed it. But apparently I even passed the psychological examination, and they thought that that would mean that it was time to interview me. So I was interviewed by 3 FBI special agents to determine if I was good for the job, and they thought so. Continued with other testing, all kinds of medical testing. And then the big deal was the FBI background investigation. And for that, you had to fill out about an 18-page form listing my teachers from elementary school, all my employers, all my friends, anything you could possibly think, because they needed to check out if Joe Bannister was an honest guy. Because you see, I was applying for a position of public trust. And in order to be worthy of a position of public trust, they need to be able to check out your background. Makes sense. So the FBI checked out my background. Apparently everything was okay, and I thought that I was cruising towards Quantico, Virginia, to become an FBI agent. But it turned out that the FBI, a hiring freeze was instituted, and they were not able to actually appoint me to become a special agent. So I spent the latter part of 1991, all of 1992, and a good part of 1993 waiting, being on the outside looking in, trying to become an FBI agent, basically my dream. And then in August of 1993, I got a call from the San Francisco office of the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. Now, as I said before, I sent an application to both the FBI and the IRS. The IRS application was more as a backup. A friend of mine who was actually a special agent in the CID said, you know, you shouldn't just apply to the FBI because there may be some reason why they can't hire you or you can't get hired. And so I applied to the CID as well, never thinking that it would actually happen or that they would call me. But I had waited so long to be in the FBI, they couldn't lift the hiring freeze. And then here was August of 1993, and the IRS gave me a call. And they said, would you be interested in being a special agent with the Internal Revenue Service Criminal Investigation Division? And at the time, I mean, I filled out the application more as an afterthought, like, well, you know, I better just do this just in case. But I wasn't really interested in working for the Internal Revenue Service. I didn't have that many friends as it was, and I knew that having a job with the IRS, I'd have even fewer. So it really wasn't the kind of job that I thought I would like, but then again, I didn't know a lot about it. So what I did is I kind of researched more about CID and what the division did within the IRS, what a special agent would do, and basically concluded that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad job after all. The reason I thought so was that, you know, you carried a gun, you went after real bad tax cheats, money launderers, drug smugglers, really opposite of what I thought. I thought an IRS special agent just sat at a desk and, you know, picked up the leftovers from the examination division or something like that, you know, the audits that had gone really bad. But I found out that it was actually seemed to be kind of an exciting type of job. You would go and get trained, you'd carry a gun, you'd have a badge, you'd have a lot of importance and work with other agencies, and I thought, gosh, maybe this wouldn't be so bad. If I work for the FBI, they might kind of pigeonhole me as an accountant, stick me with a bunch of boxes of books and records and never see the light of day. But the IRS is filled with accountants, and I'd just be one of the better ones, and maybe I'd do okay. So I decided to go ahead and interview for the position, and like the FBI, it was a panel interview. There were three special agents. I think they were all management or higher. And they went ahead, had the interview, and I apparently did well. And they offered me the job. During that same time period, they had to do another background investigation on me, because apparently the FBI or the IRS doesn't trust the FBI. Because I'm telling you, I got word from all the people that were contacted. The FBI contacted my eighth grade teacher, my people from my high school employment. They really, really checked me out. But then the IRS went back and did the same thing. So I had all my friends and relatives got all these phone calls from the FBI, and then there was kind of a lull, and then they get all these calls from the IRS about Joe Bannister. So they're really wondering what I'm doing with my life that would precipitate all these calls. So I tried to explain as best I could, well, I just want to get into federal law enforcement. So the background investigation went well with the IRS, and November of 1993, I was actually sworn in as a special agent with the IRS. And my swearing-in ceremony was kind of unique, because generally IRS employees, you know, there's a lot of them. There's like 100,000 of them in the country. And when new hires come in, they'll have a big room like this, and everybody raises their hand, and they give them the oath, and, you know, off they go to terrorize you. But in my case, for some reason, I was the only one that was in the chute at that time. So I got to go to the chief's office and be in front of the flag and have the chief swear me in all by myself. My mom and my wife and my older son and my brother came to watch me, videotaped it. I was very proud of that moment when I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. They actually do that? Yes, they actually. I mean, at least they did in 1993. So I think little did they know that how much that oath really meant to me, and little did I know how much that oath would be a guidepost for me in my not-too-distant future. But after I was sworn in, I spent about a month or so being basically a special agent but not trained. They send special agents to training back at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia. And that training for me started in January of 1994. And I was sent back to Glencoe, and the first 8 weeks of training is what they call criminal investigator training. And in that training, you can be grouped with agents from Secret Service, the U.S. Customs Service, INS, Deputy U.S. Marshals, you name it. They can have these beginner criminal investigators there to get training. My particular class, you'll be happy to know, was all IRS agents. Normally there's a mixture, but in our case there were about 45 IRS agent trainees. So So we got through our first 8 weeks of training, and actually I was elected to be president of my training class. And the reason I was elected was that the first day they needed somebody to collect the picture money, and like an idiot, I raised my hand to volunteer. So when it came time for them to elect a president, who's the only person who knew, who's the only person's name that they knew? Joe Bannister, he's the picture guy. So they elected me president of my class. The criminal investigator training is really fun. I mean, we did a ton of firearms, probably shot, I don't know, thousands of rounds out of our 6-hour 9mm pistols, shotgun training. I got sprayed in the face with pepper spray. Learned how to drive a car and swing it around in the mud and the slush and the water, and learned about constitutional law, search warrants, search and seizure, you name it. It was really interesting training. Then after the first 8 weeks, they send you back for an additional 8 weeks, and that's kind of more of an agency-specific training, where a Secret Service agent will learn about counterfeiting and protection. Customs agents will learn about imports and exports, and IRS agents learn how to prove a tax case or a money laundering case. So, I thought things are going pretty well. I qualified as an expert in firearms. I got a 95% average, academic average, and elected president of my training class. I was a very motivated individual. I worked very hard. The agency-specific training that we had, again, I was re-elected president. I worked my tail off, and in about May, June of 1994, I was sent back to the San Francisco office, fully trained. I was issued my firearm, the badge, the whole bit, so I was ready to hit the ground running. It turned out that I got, thanks, she knows that I drink a lot of water. Turned out that even though I was hired in the San Francisco office, I transferred to the San Jose office. And I was born and raised in San Jose, so I actually got to be, I thought I was in heaven. I was a federal agent in my hometown, and could basically stay there the rest of my career and just have a blast. I was the most popular guy on surveillance because I knew where all the streets were. I just made sure they never went near the house I grew up in. So I would say that from about June of 1994 until December of 1996, I had the time of my life. And I know that, most of you don't know what the inside of the IRS is like, and you're thinking, well, how could this guy have the time of his life in the IRS? But it's not like, at least the CID, the division that I was in, it's not like we, pick three taxpayers every week and turn them upside down and shook them for all the money that we could. Our investigations would last 1, 2, maybe 3 years. We went after embezzlers, people that cheated on, millions and millions of dollars in tax, where they'd sign a return saying that they made $200,000 when in reality they made $800,000. The investigations were very long and drawn out. But I was able to use my financial skills to do what I thought I was doing, which was help my country, right? Collect the income tax. It's certainly an unpopular tax, but it's something that's got to be done. A few of the interesting things that I got to do, I know there's some debate over this, but just for sake of conversation, the IRS is one of the Treasury agencies, and when there comes a presidential election, you know how there can be 30, 40, 50 people running for president at the initial stages. Secret Service is a little bit shorthanded. So they'll reach into IRS and ATF and the Customs Service and ask if any of the agents want to assist on protection details. So I can't even remember now. It would have been 96. Jack Kemp was running for office. And I got to go to Monterey, California, and be on a Secret Service detail guarding Jack Kemp. And I was really excited about doing such a detail right up until the time when I was actually doing it. And I had the trench coat. It was raining that day. I had a trench coat. I had the earpiece. I mean, I looked the part, the whole bit. And then I realized that, you know what? If somebody pulls out a gun, I got to take a bullet for Jack Kemp. The reality sunk in. So the excitement subsided a little bit after that thought. I also got to do some very interesting money laundering investigations. In fact, most of my work was in the area of money laundering investigations rather than tax investigations, although I did both. One of the more interesting cases was a man who liked to smuggle cocaine. And he smuggled cocaine by the multiple kilos. And he found out that he could sell his cocaine for a lot more money in Atlanta, Georgia, where the Olympics were, than he could in the Bay Area. So he went through this elaborate scheme to get people to shuttle his cocaine from the Bay Area to Atlanta so that he could make, you know, I don't know, 150% of what he would make in the Bay Area. And he also realized that the heat was getting a little hot on him in the Bay Area, and he needed to find another place to set up shop. So he bought a mansion in the Atlanta area, and he also bought a $100,000 Mercedes convertible. And so my job was to prove that he had laundered money. And the basics of money laundering, at least the way the statutes are written, is that if you conduct a financial transaction with the proceeds of a specified unlawful activity, you've laundered money. So in this case, this man had a cocaine business, and he took all the money that he made from it and bought nice little toys like a Mercedes convertible and a nice mansion in Atlanta, and was having a pretty good time. And so here's Joe Bannister kind of tagging along behind, picking up all the pieces, getting all the evidence to show that he actually, the way he was able to buy all of these fun toys was through his drug business. So that case took me all over the country. I got to see the inside of certain federal penitentiaries, not as an inmate, but interviewing people. I worked with all kinds of other agencies, the FBI, the DEA, state and local officers. It was a very exciting case. Of course, we were trying to get to the point where this man would be indicted, but it turned out that he got a bullet right here in the eye, close range, and my investigation kind of went downhill from there. But my point is that the people that I was investigating, I really didn't have a, it was easy to have a dislike for them. I mean, this person not only was murdered, but he's reputed to have engaged in that kind of behavior and doing those kinds of bad things. And so I thought, you know, what a neat job. Here I am, an accountant with a gun, and these people, these drug dealers have no clue that I'm back there picking up all these pieces of evidence to show that they're really bad news. They think, you know, if I never touch these drugs, I just touch all my toys, then I'm home free. But, you know, they didn't know about IRS special agents. And so I took a lot of pride in that. In fact, after that investigation was over, there was a point at which there was a seizure that was what they call a judicial forfeiture, where the judge, you know, there's a warrant, and the judge signs this order, and eventually that house was taken. But what was interesting about that case is that the neighbors, they kind of, I mean, can you imagine living in a nice neighborhood, you worked your butt off for your house, and then you find this guy that really looks like a drug dealer moves in. And you can really tell that he's a drug dealer because when he mows the lawn, he has a bodyguard that follows him as he's mowing the lawn. Now, this is what the neighbors were telling me that this guy did. You know, because, of course, my question was, well, what makes you think he's a drug dealer? So they told me stories like this. Well, he doesn't seem to work. He drives around in this $100,000 Mercedes. He's got a bodyguard when he mows the lawn. I think he might be, he kind of looks like a drug dealer. Well, it turned out that when the house was seized and he went away, these neighbors were ecstatic. And if you can believe it, I mean, this is, again, why my experience with the IRS was kind of unique. I didn't see a lot of this, the bad stuff that I've, since leaving, I've heard that goes on. A lot of these neighbors called me and thanked me for ridding their neighborhood of this bad guy. So, you know, I felt pretty good about the job I was doing. Unfortunately, the euphoria about my job kind of took a turn for the worse in December of 1996. And the reason that it took a dive was there's a lady named D.V. Kidd. How many people have heard of D.V. Kidd? Okay, quite a few. Well, for those of you who haven't heard of her, if you've got your pen, notebook ready, she's got a website at dv.com. Her first name is spelled D-E-V-V-Y. dv.com. D.V. Kidd's about 5 feet tall. She's a fireball. These are all things I learned after the fact. When I first heard D.V. Kidd, she was on a radio show in the San Francisco Bay Area. The radio station is KSFO, and actually their website is KSFO560.com. There's a host on KSFO named Jeff Metcalf. And what was interesting about Jeff Metcalf is that I listened to him when he was on a Sacramento station prior to him coming to San Francisco. And I could barely hear his show because there was so much static. But I thought, well, I really like this guy. He talks about the Constitution. He talks about the Second Amendment. He's a very honest guy. He always says it's not who is right or wrong, but he was only concerned with what is right or wrong, not who is right or wrong. So if it was Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, he didn't care. He just wanted to tell the truth. So that's the kind of experience I had listening to him. And at some point, he came to the San Francisco Bay Area, and then I could hear him quite clearly because I lived in San Jose, about 50 miles to the south. And Jeff, I used to, if you can imagine, now this is an IRS special agent, and every time I'd be out in my G car, as we called it, our government car, I had the radio glued to KSFO, a conservative talk radio station. And I listened to him religiously because I thought he was very truthful. Well, in December of 1996, he had D.V. Kidd on his show. And the day I heard him, I was driving around in my government car. I had my Sig Sauer 9mm on my left hip, my handcuffs behind my back here, and my bulletproof vest in the trunk, and all this enforcement equipment, and I'm listening to the radio, and D.V. Kidd says that the federal income tax is voluntary for most Americans. And she said that the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which is better known as the Income Tax Amendment, was never ratified. And she said that the federal income tax money that we pay doesn't even go towards paying the bills of our country. Well, can you imagine my reaction? This lady's a kook. This lady is crazy. Now, the fortunate thing, I guess, was, the reason I'm here today, was because she was saying this on Jeff Metcalf's show. And because Jeff Metcalf had established credibility with me, and I had developed a trust in him, I listened. I didn't just tune it out, as those of you who have been at this for a while know that people tend to do. They just tune it out. Well, I didn't tune it out because I thought, you know, Jeff has worked his tail off. His show is opposite of Rush Limbaugh, so he had his work cut out for him to try to get an audience, to try to tell the truth, get credibility. Why is he having this crazy lady on his show saying that the income tax is largely voluntary? So it really was a disconnect for me. I thought there's something strange about this. And as I tell people, if I had heard D.V. Kidd speaking at this place and I walked by, I would have thought, eh, those crazy kooks, you know, I would have just kept right on walking. But because she said it on Jeff Metcalf's show, I thought I better check this out. So she gave an address where I could order her booklets, and I received them in about January of 97, a few weeks after I ordered them. And the two booklets, one's called Why a Bankrupt America, and the other is called Blind Loyalty. And if you go to her website, you can order them. I think they're like $2 a piece. Well worth it, believe me. But in those books, she made even more outrageous claims than she did on the radio. She talked about corruption that was so deep that it just made my stomach turn. But again, these were just words in a book. But because of that initial Jeff Metcalf connection, I thought, you know, I really have to keep at this. I need to figure out what's going on here. Why would he have her on his show? So I spent most of 1997. Now again, you have to remember, I'm going to work every day as a special agent for the IRS. We worked 50-hour work weeks, so basically 10 hours a day. And I was a little league coach, and you know, got two sons and all of that stuff. But then I would find time to do reading and research to try to disprove this crazy stuff that DV Kid was saying. So it involved a lot of reading, and I drove my wife crazy because I like to read, but let me tell you, bookworm did not describe me during 1997 and 1998. I read and read and read. I attended meetings. One funny thing was that I went to some John Birch Society meetings, and I thought, I think the John Birch Society, they're kind of weird people, at least that's what I hear. But I would go to their meetings because they seemed to be talking about the same stuff that D.V. Kidd talked about, you know, the Federal Reserve and the monetary system. And since I was on this little investigation, I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to go sit with these people and find out what it's all about. And I didn't want them to think that I was there spying on them. So I just told them, I'm an IRS special agent. And I'm just trying to find out what's going on here. I'm sure they thought, yeah, right, buddy. But I kept showing up, and they would give me books. They said, well, you should try this book. You know, if you want to learn about this, you should read this. And did everybody hear Ed Griffin yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Ed Griffin, I didn't know who Ed Griffin was. I didn't know what the creature from Jekyll Island was. But a person from the John Birch Society said, if you really want to learn how the monetary system works, read The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's a very thick book. And so I started reading it. And I mean, if you have not read The Creature from Jekyll Island, I would highly recommend it. It can either ruin your life or save your life. I mean, it's an eye-opening book. But that's what I did for a long, long period of time, just reading, thinking, you know, there seems to be a lot of things that I was never taught in college. I was just coming to this realization at, you know, at the age of, in my 30s. You know, I don't recall any of this stuff on the CPA exam. And so I kept on researching and researching, and then it came to the point, and I kicked myself for not thinking of it sooner, but I thought, why don't I simply call these people and ask them directly? Because you see, DV Kidd, these books that she puts out, they're only about, I don't know, 50 pages a piece. And they're basically, you know, just little pamphlets. They get the job done. They got information in them. And, but she puts the telephone numbers and addresses for all these people right in the booklets. And I'll try to talk about it a little more later, but it's interesting the openness that I noticed starting with these telephone numbers compared with what I would later learn or what I would later experience with the Internal Revenue Service. So just keep that in mind. But she would put the telephone numbers of these individuals who had these various claims about income tax returns and federal income tax and monetary system and this corruption and vote fraud and all these different things. And so I just, you know, the lightning rod struck me, why not just call them and ask them, is this really true? So I flipped through the books and I thought, okay, well, who am I going to call? And the first person I decided to call was Bill Conklin. Did everybody hear Bill Conklin's speech yesterday? Well, and again, I've never heard of any of these people. They're just a name to me. They're, you know, they got to be somebody that, you know, is crazy, just like DV, right? That was my expectation, and that's what I've been taught and trained about from the IRS. So I called Bill Conklin, and I left a message on his voicemail. I had taken the day off of work. You know, government employees have lots of vacation days to burn. So I burned a vacation day calling a tax protester, so-called. I left a message on his voicemail, and I said, hello, Mr. Conklin. My name is Joe Bannister, and by day, I'm a special agent with the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. But I'm just calling to try to find out if these claims you make about the Fifth Amendment and voluntary filing of income tax returns is true. Now, can you imagine what Bill's reaction must have been? Well, he later told me that, Joe, I mean, I had never, ever, ever, ever received or thought that I would receive a call like I got from you that day. He said, special agents have called me before. Believe me, they have. But they don't identify themselves as special agents. They try to act like some poor, hapless taxpayer, and they try to get me in trouble. But you didn't do that. You told me who you were, and that you were trying to find out more about my claim that filing federal income tax returns was voluntary. Now, what was interesting, or just to start to give you an idea about what I was beginning to put at risk, or what I had to put at risk or take the chances on to get these kinds of things done, I only had one home phone number. And I needed Bill Conklin to get back in touch with me. So I had a choice. Now, remember, I did not ask the IRS, can I call Bill Conklin? Can I listen to DV Kid on the radio? I didn't ask any permission. I just wanted to find these things out. So I had two choices. I could either leave Bill Conklin my home telephone number, or I could leave him my IRS office telephone number. Not much of a choice, because at this point I hadn't told my wife this crazy, kooky stuff that I was doing and what I was trying to find out. Luckily, she wasn't home that day doing something with the kids. But I knew I couldn't have Bill Conklin call the IRS so that the receptionist would say, Joe Bannister, you've got a call from Bill Conklin, tax protester on line one. So all I could do was give him my home telephone number. And you just, you know, bear with me here. I mean, this is not something that I was really comfortable with doing, but I didn't really have a choice. But Bill Conklin's reputation, and I think it might have even been said right in DV's booklets, is that, you know, he was labeled an illegal tax protester by the IRS. And here's this idiot Joe Bannister giving him his home telephone number. I mean, what's that going to lead to? You know, is the militia going to be knocking at my door asking me to volunteer, or what does this lead to? Well, it didn't turn out to be too bad, because Bill Conklin didn't turn out to be too bad. He called me back an hour or so later, and I'm sure he was a little bit apprehensive. But he said, so what are your questions? And I just went into it, that I had listened to DV on Jeff Metcalf's show, read about Bill Conklin, and I was quite intrigued with his claim that filing federal income tax returns was voluntary, because I said, surely that's not the case. I mean, part of my authority, my job, would be to investigate somebody that didn't file a federal income tax return. It's mandatory for everybody, isn't it? And he said, no, it's not. And he began to describe his situation and the court battles that he fought and the Fifth Amendment issue. And, you know, I'm not a judge or a lawyer, but as a special agent, one of the things that we were instructed about was the Fifth Amendment. And that if we were going to be speaking to someone and we were trying to get information from them, we had to tell them up front that they didn't have to talk to us. We could not compel them to provide us with testimony. They couldn't. We just could not shake them and say, "You better tell me where's the tax return buried." If they didn't want to talk to us, they could tell us to pound sand. The reason for that is the Fifth Amendment. So I could kind of understand what Bill Conklin was driving at. You people that file tax returns present an awful lot of information on those returns. Whether you're married, how many kids you have, how much money you make. When you file such a return like that and you sign it under penalty of perjury, you know that you're signing that you understand it all. Do you? Well, that's what you're signing, that you understand it. It's true, correct, and complete. But you're providing the government with an awful lot of information. And they can use that in a criminal case against you, believe me. One of the first things that a special agent does when he starts a tax investigation is to order up a tax return that you filed. In fact, all the tax returns that you filed. And those returns get put in a drawer that's all the evidence against you. Well, Bill Conklin had done a lot of study, obviously, and also some litigation. And one of the more famous cases, the case that he talks about, is I guess the judge basically ruled against Bill. But in his ruling against Bill, he said, you know, your Fifth Amendment rights don't apply in this situation, Mr. Conklin, because the filing of a federal income tax return is voluntary. This from a federal judge. Well, when Bill showed me the transcript and all of this stuff, I thought, well, that's curious. Why is a federal judge admitting that the federal income tax return filing is voluntary? So, I mean, I was blown away. I thought, this can't be true. So I tried to check out everything that he said. I thought, I'm not going to take anything this guy says seriously. I mean, it can't be true. But I kept checking and checking, trying to disprove it, and basically could not. I mean, it really happened. He really had that court case, and the judge really said, you know, I'm not going to overturn this whole system for you, Mr. Conklin, and your Fifth Amendment rights weren't affected because the filing of that return was voluntary. And if you may or may not know that you can voluntarily waive your rights. If I was an IRS special agent and I came up to you and I said, you don't have to talk to me, but would you like to answer some questions? And you stupidly say, yes, I'll answer any of your questions. And I ask you, and then you proceed to admit about all the whatever purported crimes you might have done, all of that could be admissible against you because you waived your right. You gave me all the information freely. I didn't put my hands around your neck or anything. So I thought that was a very interesting topic that Bill Conklin came up with. And the interesting thing was that he'd been labeled an illegal tax protester, and I thought, well, you know, I didn't meet him until many months later, but I expected Bill Conklin to drool, to have trouble hearing him, you know, because he'd be so incoherent, to be going off on these tangents and plucking, what do they say, the IRS says that they pluck little bits and pieces out of different cases. Well, he didn't do that. He was completely the opposite of what I expected. Had a master's in communications, very learned man, and a very, very nice man. So in a sense, that was kind of strike one, you know, for the IRS. I mean, it was not what I expected, but clearly this man had some credibility. Well, the next person that I decided to talk to, because I, you know, wasn't through making trouble in my life, Devi had other people in her booklets. And the other person that she had in her books was a man named Bill Benson. And how many people have heard of Bill Benson? Quite a few. Well, he researched whether or not the 16th Amendment had actually been ratified. And he traveled to every state, every one of the 48 contiguous states, went to their state archives, and actually went back to the votes and determined, and he told me this on the phone, he said, not a single state ratified the 16th Amendment. And I thought, wow, who does this guy think he is? You know, because all these people were new to me. I had no idea who they were, how much work they had done, and you know, I thought I was a big deal, CPA, special agent. I knew it all, right? Well, that wasn't the case. But you know, I wasn't arrogant about it, but I just thought, this cannot be true. But over a period of months, Bill Benson mailed me everything that I asked for. You know, he didn't guide me on what I should look at. I decided what things I wanted to look at or prove. And he sent me tons of documentation, sent me his books. I talked to Larry Beecraft, a bunch of very credible people, and saw a bunch of credible documents that convinced me that this guy was really telling the truth. A couple things, one thing that he did that really cemented our relationship was that one of the states, Kentucky, actually voted to reject the 16th Amendment. But the Secretary of State, the United States Secretary of State, recorded Kentucky as being one of the states that ratified the 16th Amendment. So Bill Benson sent me, I think he only had two, he sent me one of two of his certified copies of the Kentucky resolution showing the vote, that they actually rejected it. It had the ribbon and the seal and the whole bit. And he never had met me. He had no reason to trust me, but he sent me the original document. And again, remember what I was telling you about how open people were with me? Well, that continued, believe me. In fact, Bill, what he put on that that note that he sent me with the Kentucky resolution, he said, this is for all the doubting Thomases out there. He was really, I thought, God, this is a real document. This is the real thing, and he's sending it to me. Well, that was one of the gestures that he did. A couple of the stories that he told me, one of the more ugly stories that he told me, and what really got me thinking that there was something going very wrong, was that, you know, he was pursued with a criminal investigation and prosecution by the IRS and the Department of Justice. And he told me the story about at one point when they're getting ready for trial, the assistant U.S. attorney has a discussion with them. You know what a plea bargain is. They're basically trying to talk things over. Hey, can we make a deal? Well, Bill had kind of a special case. The prosecutor asked him, she said, you know, we can give you a job that pays you really big money, and we can go easy on you on these tax charges if you will provide us with your 17,000 original documents proving that the 16th Amendment was never ratified. Now, I'd worked with my share of assistant U.S. attorneys, because an investigator, you do the investigation, you put the report together, and then you go to the prosecutor and try to get it prosecuted. I had no idea that a federal prosecutor had the authority to horse trade over historical documents of such a significance. Is it significant to you that the 16th Amendment may not have been ratified? Is it significant to you that a federal prosecutor said, I don't think I want them to know? Well, it was significant to me because I was, and still consider myself, a fraud investigator. And if that didn't smell like fraud, I don't know what did. So in a sense, that was kind of strike two for the IRS in my mind. And this is progressing over a long period of time. I'm still going to work every day trying to stay motivated. I was getting tougher and tougher. I'm glossing over a lot of things. I mean, I just did a boatload of research. I've got so many file cabinets and binders and evidence and documentation, it's not funny. I mean, it just, again, drives my wife crazy. But it's proof to me. I wanted proof. I wanted to see it with my own eyes. I wanted to see whether these people had credibility. And in my opinion, they do. So there were a number of other people I talked to. I did also gloss over that one of the people I talked to was Paymon. And I thought, you know, what's a Paymon? I mean, Bill Conklin introduced me to this guy named Paymon, and this is where I'm thinking, what have I got myself into? I'm talking to this illegal tax protester. He's got my home phone number. He's giving my name and number to a person named Paymon. He's from Iran. I mean, it was some heart-pounding stuff. But just talked to all kinds of people. I talked to Jack McLam. I talked to all these people while I was still an agent. And I did it on my own time. I didn't go and ask the IRS for permission to look into these issues because somehow I thought they wouldn't give me permission. But I guess there just came a point when I knew that, you know, there was really a problem here. that all the stuff that I had tried to disprove, I could not. Now, I knew that there were scams out there, and there were people that were saying stuff that was way out there, and I couldn't really comprehend. But the people that I had communicated with, the DV kids, the Bill Conklins, the Bill Bensons, the Paymons, people that I thought, these people are nothing like what the IRS has described them to be. And it made me realize that, you know, I wonder if the people that I'm working for, if this agency is sold me a bill of goods, that they've been telling me a lie all these years. And fortunately, I decided to look into it and found that, you know, I think the IRS is lying about these people. They don't want others to listen to them, so they discredit them, and it's pretty effective, isn't it? And I think that might be why I don't hear much from the IRS, at least not so far. Maybe they're planning something for me. But it's a little difficult to call me anti-tax, anti-government. Those labels, I don't think, would stick very well. So far, they haven't leveled them against me. There's still time, I'm sure. But bottom line was, I came to the realization that, you know, there's really a problem here. And I had to think about, I had to really meditate about what was important in my life, because I knew that I was going to have to start asking some very tough questions and deciding what I was going to do. And I thought about my oath, obviously, but I took an oath to God to support and defend the Constitution. And it looked to me as though the IRS, in the way it administered the federal income tax, was outside of its authority, had spread its web way far out from where it should actually be. And I knew that because of that, people's rights were very likely being violated, and I needed to do something about it. I thought about the Ninth Commandment, which forbids me from bearing false witness against my neighbor. I thought about my upbringing. I thought about my children, about my wife. I thought about everything that was important to me. How can I, if I've learned all of these things, do I just put my blinders back on, go back and collect my paycheck, and then I'm going to be able to look at my kids in the face when they do something wrong, and I say, you've got to do the right thing no matter what? So those are the kinds of thoughts that were going through my head, and I called DV Kidd at about that time, and I wanted to thank her for ruining my life. Among other things. Now, she's a wonderful lady, and I called to tell her, you know, I've been doing a lot of research, basically a personal investigation, and, you know, I found out that you're telling the truth. Of course, Stevie said, well, of course I'm telling the truth. You know, one in her booklet, her original booklet, and she hates that I say this, but she said that IRS agents insult the word slime. And even though she hates me telling you that, I'm telling you that had an effect on me. I am not slime. So I talked to DV about my whole journey, and you know, DV being who she is, she said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I took an oath, and I found out what I believe to be some very bad things that this agency is doing, and I'm going to start speaking up about it. So I decided to put together the highlights of my research and all my evidence, and I put it into the form of a 90-page report, and I did it very similar to how I would do a criminal investigation. Gather all the facts and evidence and testimony of witnesses and present the report showing that they're, you know, the case merited criminal prosecution or dismissal of the investigation. Well, I knew how to write a report like that, so I put together a report on the federal income tax and all my research. I called it preliminary, and it didn't look like this when I submitted it. I mean, Paymon's done a pretty nice job, don't you think? But I put a preliminary report because, as I say, I'm not a judge or a lawyer. I'm a CPA. I've got a fair amount of competence. I can shoot straight. They trusted me with a gun, and I've come to this conclusion. But I'm going to call it preliminary because I haven't gotten the other side. I mean, I think I've gotten the other side because they seem to be lying an awful lot about these people they call tax protesters. But I wanted to get the IRS's position because my bottom line was, you've given me a gun and handcuffs and pepper spray and bulletproof vest to enforce these laws, and I want to know that what I'm doing is right. Once you let me know that, I can move on with my life. So I submitted the report to my immediate supervisor, and I included a letter with the report, and I recounted all of my credentials, all the awards that I had won, and I was the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force Coordinator, the Asset Forfeiture Coordinator. I was a Grade 13 Special Agent. I had Special Act Awards. I didn't do that to brag, just simply to say, you know, I mean, I've worked my butt off here. I'm not a bozo, but yet I've come to this some very unexpected conclusions. And I need you to help me find the error of my analysis, if any. If you can't help me find the error of my analysis, then I'm going to have to resign, because I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and I can't serve two masters. There's a problem here I need to find out so that I can move on. So I gave the report to my boss, and that was on February 8th of last year. February 11th, I was called into my chief's office, and he said, he kind of looked at me like I had two heads, and he said, "Joe, are you really serious about this?" And I looked at him in the eye and I said, "I'm dead serious about this. I just spent 2.5 years researching this. There's a problem here and I have a duty to report it." I didn't show him this memo, but I brought it along. This is from Charles Rosati. It's dated April 22nd, 1998. And he says, among other things, "Integrity is defined as adherence to a code of moral or ethical values, or more simply, honesty. An ethical climate where issues can be discussed openly, where we are doing the right thing, and where allegations of misconduct and impropriety are immediately reported to inspection, are key factors in assuring the public's confidence in the tax system." April 22nd of 1998. This other sentence, "The responsibility for reporting misconduct is a basic obligation we assume as public servants." Charles Rosati, the commissioner of the IRS. Stupid me, I actually believe that he meant that. And I believe that I had a duty to follow this. So I said to my chief, "I'm dead serious about this. I need to get some resolution on these matters so that I can continue in this job." So he said, dutifully complied with my request. I asked him to forward it up the chain of command up to and including Commissioner Rosati. And he did what I asked. February 17th, which will be about, 6 days later, I got a call from my chief in the early afternoon, and he said, "Joe, how long are you going to be staying here tonight?" And I thought, when has the chief ever called me to ask me how late I'm going to be staying? I always work through lunch. Everybody knows I work hard. Everybody knows I stay late. Why does he want this? What's going on? What's happening? My heart started pounding. He said, "Well, you know that issue you've discussed with me? We've got a resolution on it, and I've got some paperwork that I'd like you to see." So he said, "I'll give you a call when it's complete." So a few hours later, he called me back and said, it's ready to go. Would you come on up?" And I came up, and let me see if I can find it here in my jumble. He gave me a very short memorandum, and he told me, "Joe, you know, I've dealt with a lot of integrity issues in my career, but never an integrity issue quite like this. Because your integrity issue deals with the fact that you're having trouble enforcing these laws." And he said, "So I've never dealt with this, and I'm not quite sure how to proceed, so I'm being told how to proceed. And I've been instructed to give you this memorandum." And it was a very short memorandum, and it said, among other things, "The Internal Revenue Service will not be responding to your request and will provide you with the necessary paperwork to tender your resignation. You will be placed on administrative leave effective upon receipt of this memorandum for a period of 7 calendar days to consider what actions you wish to take." So I realized that I was about ready to embark on an unplanned vacation. It was 1999, a year ago, a little over a year ago. So I realized that, wow, things are really moving quickly. looks like there's some problems here. They're putting me on admin leave. This is a big problem. What am I going to tell my wife? What am I going to tell my kids? What am I going to tell my family? What have I done? Interestingly enough, they were trying to be kind, and they said, "Well, Joe, you know, we're putting you on admin leave, but you know, there's a book that special agents have to sign in and sign out, so their boss knows where they're at." And so they were trying to be nice. They said, "Joe, you don't have to put admin leave in the book, because if you put admin leave, that has a certain connotation to other law enforcement officers. That means you've done something really bad. And so that you don't have to put admin leave. We don't want people asking, you know, what's going on with you." It was very kind of them. They also said that I didn't need to clean out my desk. I said, that's very kind of you to offer. I went downstairs, and I wrote in the biggest letters that I could, A-D-M-I-N, admin, so that everyone would look in that book and see that I was on admin leave. I went back to my desk, and I cleaned it off spotless. I even waxed it. I took my wedding pictures, my bumper stickers. I had a couple of bumper stickers that were actually pretty popular in the office. One said, fear the government that fears your guns. The other one said, the experts agree gun control works, and it's got a picture of Stalin, Gaddafi, Hitler, Castro. You can see that I wasn't too afraid of letting people know how staunch of a constitutional protector I was. But I took everything away, because the next morning I wanted to make absolutely certain that everyone knew that Joe Bannister, who had done a pretty darn good job all those years, all of a sudden was gone. So I went, I got started on my unplanned vacation on February 17th, and they'd basically given me, 7 days to respond. It was basically the following Friday was when I was supposed to respond. That would be Friday the 26th. And it was a difficult week for me because I didn't know quite what to do. I thought, you know, this is cruising towards a point when I may be losing this job. I was getting paid with benefits and all the goodies, maybe about $80,000 a year. I had taken the job believing that I was going to spend a whole career at it, and here I had really gone down a road that there was no turning back from. But you can see by their response that they were kind of putting things back in my lap. What are you going to, kind of like Devi said, what are you going to do about it, Joe? So I decided to start composing my resignation letter, and I composed a resignation letter to Commissioner Rosati, and it's actually on my website. For those of you who haven't been there, it's freedomabovefortune.com. And I basically recounted all of my, everything about me, what I was authorized to do, how hard I had worked, and my confusion at the way I was being treated. Especially in view of the memo that I read to you and all the pronouncements that talked about all the integrity and honesty and all these things that were supposed to be a part of administering this income tax. And apparently these people weren't interested in that. So it was interesting, the calendar and the timing of it, because February 26th was kind of the drop-dead date. That was the day that I was supposed to tell them I was leaving or staying or whatever. Well, the day prior to that, February 25th, was my birthday. And February 25th is also the day in history when the 16th Amendment was proclaimed to be ratified. So I thought to myself, okay, this is a tough decision. I can get an extra 8 hours of government pay and resign on the 26th, or I can resign a day earlier on a day that I'll never forget. So on Thursday, the 25th, I called up my boss and I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to resign. So I came in and turned in my pager, my computer, my handcuffs, my bulletproof vest, every piece of enforcement equipment, everything. Severed it all. Turned it all in. And it was interesting, on the one of the separation letters, my boss put, due to the voluntary resignation of Joe Bannister. I thought it was interesting, that word, voluntary. But at about 4:30 on Thursday the 25th, I walked out of the door of the IRS. Clearly, I didn't fit in, apparently. I wanted to, but I didn't fit in. I mean, there were things like, this is a document that says, I'm proud to be a special agent and will fulfill the responsibilities placed in me by the service and my country. I'm dedicated to uphold the provisions of the Constitution of the United States and the policies and procedures of the service. I mean, there was a time I was very proud to be a federal law enforcement officer. But I don't know about you, but I think it's very, very suspicious that this agency didn't want to talk about this. Now, some of the agents I heard through the grapevine were saying, Joe, you just didn't ask it in the right way. Well, I have proof, I believe, that that isn't the issue, because in July of last year, I was fortunate to be invited to Washington, D.C., to the National Press Club, and a very brave gentleman named Bob Schultz put on a symposium there. It was called the IRS Showdown, and Bob Schultz got wind of this crazy special agent who resigned over this issue, and he had me on his radio show, and it kind of turned him on to all this stuff that was going on. He had already been fighting the state of New York, and, you know, he knew that the government had a little corruption here and there. But he glommed onto this issue because he couldn't believe how astounding it was that, you know, somebody like me would research it and then just be blown off by the IRS. I mean, just say, hit the road, buddy. So he put together this symposium, and he gave the government officials, and I'm talking about the Treasury Department, the Internal Revenue Service, the Congress, the Clinton administration, you name it, he sent them an invitation, a formal invitation, certified mail, return receipt requested, inviting them, giving them two months notice to show up during the week at the National Press Club to debate or discuss these various issues that are in my report, or a lot of the stuff that you've heard this weekend. And do you know that not a single bureaucrat showed up? They couldn't spare a single government employee. After we all flew from all over the country, we came to their backyard, and they couldn't spare one person. So at least I felt vindicated that, wouldn't you think that that was asking in the right way? The government didn't want to show. So they're definitely they're keeping pretty silent on this, and you know, I kind of like to talk to people and be open with them. And as I said before, that's the way that D.V. Kidd and Bill Conklin and Paymon and all these people, Free Enterprise Society, very, very open with me, very open. And wouldn't you think that if they had snake oil and garbage and they're trying to cheat you, that they'd kind of hold it close to the vest? Like, well, I'm going to show you just this much, because if you see this much, you're not going to like what you see. They are very open. Now, compare that with the behavior of the IRS over the last 13 or 14 months. They don't want to talk about it at all. They don't want to talk about why a special agent did the research and came to this conclusion. They'd rather see him walk out the door. So I find that very, very suspicious. But the government didn't show up on July 2nd of last year. And by the way, if you'd like to find out more about that, you can go to givemeliberty.org. And actually, Paymon has a tape, because although the government didn't show up, C-SPAN 2 did. And C-SPAN 2 broadcast on national television Larry B. Craft, D.V. Kidd, Bill Conklin, Bill Benson, and myself, and others, Bob Schultz, the host, and had us all telling our stories about all of this stuff and having no government officials. Representative Traficant actually showed up at the luncheon. He ate lunch, answered about two questions, and got out. But other than that, no one showed up to the symposium to discuss these issues. So C-SPAN 2 broadcast the entire production, and I remember getting a call from one of my cousins in the Midwest saying, Joe, I saw you on TV. I mean, we couldn't believe that they actually had broadcast it nationally, and they rebroadcast it three or four times. And we found out from C-SPAN that they had gotten more requests for this videotape than anything they've ever broadcasted. So you'd think that C-SPAN getting all these orders and there'd be all this interest that they'd want to do it again, right? Well, we came back in November of last year and did it again. This time we had even more interesting information. Bill Benson was going to announce the name of the U.S. senator who, through an attorney, tried to bribe him into not releasing his book, The Law That Never Was. We had a man named Dave Bossett, who, after researching the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations, with the help of, it's called taxgate.com, went through the procedures with the IRS as far as the payroll tax goes and ended up with a refund check. And, you know, I guess those are kinds of things that the government, somebody doesn't want to be known. So somebody bought the time that we were supposed to be broadcasted with, and we didn't get broadcasted. Strange. Very strange. So it's been kind of an uphill battle trying to spread the word. I don't do this full time. I'm gone back to being a mild mannered accountant, which, as I told you, I love so much. Kind of extinguished my law enforcement career. But I don't do this full time. I do have my website. I try to get out when I can. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I've put my family through hell, and I'm not, you know, I owe them some responsibilities myself. And so I just can't be everywhere. And I wish there were more agents that would learn about this, because I must tell you, I wasn't hired and they said, okay, Joe, here's the secret. All these stupid idiots out here are paying this tax and it's really voluntary. And most of them don't know. They haven't researched it, but I took the time and researched it, and here's the conclusion that I came to. I'm just hopeful that sooner or later someone else will take the time, do the research, and then they'll be up here on the stage next year. But in the meantime, it's really up to you to spread the word the best that you can. I've talked to many people who say, thank God for you, thank God you put your picture on this book, because I've been trying to tell my father for the last 7 years about this stuff, and he says I'm crazy. And, you know, ultimately, if my face, because it's already out there, it's too late now, but if my face and what I experienced is helpful to get people to at least look at this. Remember, my report's called preliminary. I don't have all the answers, but I know darn well that the behavior of the government stinks to high heaven. Their behavior shows me that they're not acting above board, pretty plain. And I think the American people need to know that. Look at what it did to me. I thought that there was some semblance of righteousness, and, you know, it was unpopular, but I mean, there was some basis for it. And it turned out that there was little to none. And it really bothered me. It bothered me enough to quit my job and change my life forever. So I'm hopeful that you will each go out and spread the word. I'm hoping that you will write to your congressman. I'm hoping first that you'll research this. For those of you who aren't familiar with any of these things about me saying the income tax is probably voluntary for you, the 16th Amendment, do your homework. Take your time. That's what the internet is for. It's free. I've got a copy of, there's a third of my report. It's on my website. You can download it. Take the time to educate yourselves and then start to tell your friends and neighbors that they're being deceived, at least in my opinion. Let them make up their own minds. And really, that's all we can do. The government has very deep pockets. They've got lots of lawyers, and there's 3,000 minus one special agents that are still out there. So don't act before you think. Don't act before you educate yourself. There's time. Just the best thing you can do is exercise your First Amendment rights. And one of the ways you can exercise them is by writing to your congressman, to the president, to the Supreme Court. Write to all the branches of government. Write to people and say, you know, I heard a guy named Joe Bannister who sounded pretty credible. And I'm taking a leap here that you believe that. But he's just trying to find out if this is the truth, and the government won't respond. And you know what? That's not what America is all about. This government has got to respond, and I want them to respond, and I want you to start debating these issues with the DV Kids and the Larry B. Crafts and the Paymons and the Free Enterprise Society and all these people who have done their homework. And it really is up to you. And if you don't do anything or you run into people that don't care, I would suggest that you tell them, you know, when you do file your tax return, just double or triple the amount that it says you owe at the bottom. In fact, why not just send in all of your money? Because ultimately, if you don't care, then your property and everything that you work for will ultimately be taken away. It's worth nothing. It is not protected. Let's see if that makes them change their tune. So I thank you very much for listening. If you were expecting a step-by-step process on how to escape the income tax, I don't have it. All I have is what I've experienced, and I think that the power of the truth will prevail. Thank you.
If you want to help expose how the IRS is destroying the U.S. Constitution and our rights, and what you can do about it, contact We the People Foundation at www.givemeliberty.org or contact Freedom Law School at www.livefreenow.org or call us at area code 760-868-4271. To receive additional copies of this presentation on CD or audio cassette at no charge, contact Freedom Law School at www.livefreenow.org or call us at area code 760-868-4271. 4271.